It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll hear about the career of late journalist Alexander Coburn and his last book.
First, Governor Walker and the legislature have introduced 8 bills they say will be priorities in the fall session geared toward improving the state's workforce development.
The bills would come at a cost, however, about $8.5 million in additional state spending, with another $14 million in federal matching dollars expected over the next year and a half.
Joining us now is Glenn Moberg, WPR's reporter in Wausau. He's been covering this story. And Glenn, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, hi, Veronica. It's great to be back. Hi, Rob.
Well, let's start with an overview on what these bills would do.
Well, he made the announcement today at the 3rd annual Small Business Summit. Small business people are very, very important to Scott Walker's agenda. He was there with his Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clefish, and he unveiled these 8 bills. And as you described, it would mean an additional $8.5 million in new state funds, and that should secure an additional $14 million in new federal funds for vocational rehabilitation programs. The entire thrust of this is workforce development, education, and training people for the new high-tech jobs that are out there. And at one point, the governor gave a lengthy address to this room full of small business people. There were hundreds of people there, and it almost sounded like a campaign event, almost like he was kicking off his reelection. He went through a PowerPoint describing the differences between the Doyle administration and what he described as a pro-business attitude of his administration. And at one point, he even said that we should be encouraging 6th graders and middle schoolers to start thinking about their careers and start thinking about how they can get training at technical colleges tied in with their high school so that they can, if they don't go on to a 4-year school, they can get right out of high school and join the workforce.
Glenn, do you think that he had his eye on those 250,000 jobs promised, or was he, you know, looking at something else?
Well, I asked him about that. And in the PowerPoint, he mentioned that he'd created 62,000 jobs over the first 2 years. Now, if you add in the 2013 figures, according to one analysis, it's up to about 90,000, which means he's about a third of the way to that 250,000 mark without a lot of time. But he put great credence in the fact that more than 11,000 new businesses have been created in Wisconsin over the last couple of years, and he thinks that those are going to be the impetus, the force that spurs the additional jobs. Now, whether he can make the 250,000 is questionable, but it is something I asked him. And why don't I just play about a 2-minute portion of that interview I had with the governor today, and you can hear him in his own words.
Absolutely. Let's hear it.
Governor, you mentioned the 250,000 jobs on your PowerPoint. It said you've created 62,000 in the first couple of years. Do you think it's realistic that you're going to hit that 250,000 figure in your first term? And if so, what do you have to do to turn it around?
Yeah, we're still focused on that. We think the numbers, it's part of the reason why the Federal Reserve Bank, I mean, this was one of the best years we've had in a couple, or summers we've had in the past couple decades in terms of job growth, according to their assessment. And so we look at it as an indicator and say, we had steady job growth, but we'd like to see it at a faster pace than we did the first 2 years. The 62,000 jobs were for the first 2 years, 2011, 2012. They don't reflect at all 2013 yet. And so we think that pace is going to pick up dramatically. And it's why today I highlighted that 11,000-plus number in terms of new businesses, because we think that's the key. It's a compounding factor that as you see more businesses, net new business creation ultimately leads, as I say, if each of them are adding 2, 5, 10 jobs, whatever the number might be, depending on the size of the business, that quickly compounds that larger job number. And so we feel good about it. But as I also mentioned in the presentation, that's why we continue to lay out an aggressive plan working with the legislature on workforce development. We'll be laying out in the next couple of days more things on overall economic development and government reform, as well as improvements in education, all of which we will think help improve the job climate in the state.
Could you speak briefly about the importance of education and training in developing the workforce of the future?
Well, I think it's incredibly important. It's why 2 years ago we gave tools to technical colleges to more than make up for the changes in the budget. They've been using that now the last couple of years to invest new dollars in the workforce training. It's why we put $100 million in total in this budget and why our first focus on our legislative agenda is on workforce development, because we believe in the end that we have 30 to 40,000 people a week just on our Department of Workforce Development website where there's job openings but not enough people to fill those jobs with the skills needed. That's the next critical step for economic development in the state.
And that is Governor Walker speaking in Stevens Point, just about an hour ago. And he mentioned the Federal Reserve Bank. That's the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, and they have rated Wisconsin as number two in the nation for recent economic growth.
So that's some good news.
Yeah, that's the statistic that he was pointing to there. And again, you know, the whole thrust of this was workforce development. And if you break those new bills down, he's talking about smart investments, in his words, in apprenticeship training programs, vocational rehabilitation services for those with special needs, assistance for the unemployed who want to transition into new careers. But that assistance will have strings. The government is really going to be ratcheting up the requirement that people look for work. Incentives for high schools, graduating students with job-ready credentials, scholarships for high school seniors who excel in technical education courses, getting state licenses tested, trained, and to work faster, helping low-income and low-skilled workers transition into employment, and then tuition reimbursement for apprentices and employers. Those are those eight bills in a nutshell. Needless to say, not everybody is really sanguine about this. Peter Barca, who's a minority leader in the Wisconsin State Assembly, said it was far too little, far too late.
Now, I want to ask you about that, because Governor Walker, in the clip you just played, mentioned support for tech schools. Now, he has come under critics before for defunding technical schools. So where's the balance here?
Yeah, he cut the technical schools' budgets by 30%. And so his opponents, the Democrats, of course, are saying this is hypocritical. You're giving them more money, but look at all that you took away in the past. The governor would counter that what he's doing now are what he would call smart investments. But let me quote from Peter Barca, since we just quoted from Governor Walker. He says, at a time Wisconsin needs big, bold action, today Republicans announced baby steps. No amount of money spent on television ads will be able to hide the fact that Republicans have not prioritized economic recovery and job creation. They made anti-education, anti-worker, anti-healthcare, anti-women agendas their first priorities. And he said that in terms of the 250,000 jobs, the governor is trying to move the goalpost and count those jobs differently.
I see.
There you have it.
Now, Glenn, you said that this smelled to you like a campaign event and not necessarily an announcement, a press conference of sorts. So did it smell like a presidential run?
I don't know. It felt more like a run for reelection for governor.
I see.
And at one point, in fact, at the very end of his speech to these small business leaders, he said, you know, my father was a preacher, and a friend of his came up to him and said, why do you always preach to the choir? And the governor said, because I want them to sing. And then he said to all these business people, I want you to sing about my administration. I want you to sing about my pro-business climate. I want you to sing in the days ahead so that every voter in this state can hear you. Now, that sounds like that felt like a campaign appearance to me.
Now, there has been some back and forth about, you know, whether Wisconsin is friendly for business, how it compares to Minnesota. How did the small business people who were there respond?
Oh, the small business people were pretty enthusiastic. In fact, they it gave him a couple of very rousing ovations. And, a lot of them, I think, are his base. He quoted another statistic. He said during the Doyle administration, 4% of small business people said the government was on the right track in Wisconsin. Now it's 94%. Whether you can trust those statistics, I don't know.
All right. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for being here today.
All right. Thanks, guys.
As Glenn Moberg, WPR's reporter in Wausau, and he was at that event with Governor Walker today in Stevens Point.
Coming up next, a road trip through political scandal, corruption, and American culture. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, we're having trouble reaching our scheduled guest, Andrew Coburn, right now. We're going to pick up where we left off talking to Glenn Moberg about jobs in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do you think Wisconsin needs to do to create more jobs? Do you think the state is on the right track when it comes to the economy and job creation? If you had advice to give to Governor Walker, to state legislators, to a Democratic gubernatorial candidate, call us at 800-642-1234. Strike that. It looks like we have our guest coming on the line. I'm going to turn around and look at the call-in person here. Andrew Coburn is coming on with us in just a moment. He's going to talk about his brother's book. Irish-born journalist Alexander Coburn came to the U.S. in 1972, set out on a career challenging some of the most powerful people and institutions in American politics.
He chronicled 18 years worth of stories and experiences in a new book, putting the finishing touches on it just days before he died of colon cancer last year.
The book is called A Colossal Wreck, a road trip through political scandal, corruption, and American culture. We talked to Alexander's brother, Andrew Coburn. He's a journalist and author. He wrote the introduction to A Colossal Wreck. Andrew, welcome to the show. Andrew, welcome to the show. Are you sorry, I don't think we had you up there.
Can you hear me?
I can, yes. So talking about Alexander Coburn, reading through his work in this new book and in the past, it struck me that this is a journalist who's not necessarily out to make friends with his writing. He didn't mind who he offended. Can you talk about that attitude toward journalism?
Well, he believed, you know, one of his favorite sort of aphorisms about newspapers was from Joseph Pulitzer, which is, you know, a newspaper should have no friends. Alexander had a lot of friends, but he didn't think that, you know, back scratching was part of the agenda. He thought that he wrote it like he saw it. And so, you know, if you read the book, you can see there's a lot of people he speaks, you know, very commendably about. But when he caught someone out, he thought they were behaving badly, he said so.
He came at the world from a perspective, I think, loosely speaking, fairly speaking, on the left. We can talk about some labels people have tried to attach to him. That didn't mean he supported the Democratic Party in the United States or President Obama or President Clinton. Can you talk about what he thought about those two political figures?
Well, I think one of the very first times he read about Obama, he called him slithery. So from that, you can see what he thought about him. He just thought, you know, he thought they were both from the same mold, you know, ambitious fellows who were prepared to, you know, who got themselves elected were on a sort of left agenda. If you remember Obama's 28 campaign, it was actually pretty, you know, very progressive and, you know, inspired so many people, especially young people. And then when he got in, as Alexander had predicted, you know, he immediately, you know, hires basically the upper tier of Citibank to Citicorp to run the economic front, people chosen by Robert Rubin, and, you know, and pursued a, you know, as now many people I think would now agree, pursued a very, well, let's be polite and call it conservative centrist agenda. And really the same with Clinton. I mean, you know, just think about Clinton's, you know, welfare so-called reform. I mean, I don't want to spend all your time discussing all that, but I'm just saying that Alexander saw them as having betrayed, you know, the principles, the professed principles on what they got elected, and that's why he wrote the way he did.
You challenge a couple of labels in your foreword to the book that people put on Alexander. People called him un-American or anti-American. You, right off the bat, don't buy that.
Absolutely not. Alexander loved America. He spent a large part of his life, you know, living in England and Ireland, where we grew up. But this was the country in where he was happy that he adopted. He became a citizen, became an American. And actually, he knew the place incredibly well. What he really liked to do was to get in one of the many fairly decrepit classic cars that he collected over the years. I think he left 10 when he died. And drive around the country, you know, to nooks and crannies that, you know, most people would never hear of, let alone visit. And in fact, one of his closest friends was a classic Chrysler dealer in near Spartanburg, South Carolina, Dave Eller. And Alexander would, you know, go to Dave and pick up yet another something on which he'd set his heart, you know, 62 Chrysler Imperial or something, and drive it back across the country with mini encounters with AAA men and speed cops and other interesting aspects of the fauna along the way.
He'd challenge the highway patrol sometimes. I think I read that this car was not physically capable of going as fast as they claimed to have clocked him.
Well, that's right. I think that was the 64 Newport that spent 6 years in a field, and birds had built nests in it. So I was amazed it went anywhere but downhill, but still he got it on the road.
Another label you challenge is the idea of calling him a contrarian. He definitely has a contrary perspective. Why can't we call him a contrarian as a journalist?
It's not so much. It's my irritation of the actual word. I think it implies people who call themselves contrarians. It's just like a, you know, just being a contrary, being contrary to something just for the sake of being contrary, which wasn't his attitude at all. You know, he didn't, and unlike some people we could mention, he didn't sort of try and, you know, get publicity or promote himself by being, oh, the person who always took the opposite side. I mean, people call him that because he took some positions that, you know, surprised people. He didn't sort of fit, you know, he didn't sort of get up in the morning and put on the uniform of, you know, your standard left, you know, liberal left commentator, you know, complete with, you know, cap and boots and bell and whistle. He, as I said at the beginning, he called it like he saw it. So, for example, he was he frequently wrote about the Fully Informed Jury Association, which is actually considered normally a sort of right-wing, almost a sort of, you know, very right-wing cause. You know, the traditional American belief that a jury can do what it wants without being bossed around by judges and lawyers. Now, that's, you know, that fits into the right-wing slot, and yet he believed in it and said so. There were many examples like that.
Well, though coming from the left, he saw things to like in the conservative populist movement in this country.
He did. I mean, I've just mentioned one, but you know, he liked the sort of state, you know, exactly the conservative populist tradition in this country. And he had a pretty keen nose for liberal hypocrisy. I mean, for example, if you look through the book, I think there are frequent sallies against the eugenicists, you know, people who, you know, the big promoters of eugenics earlier in the 20th century in America, who were all liberals. A fact he never failed to point out. So, I mean, you might think on a superficial, you know, take that he had a sort of very zigzag political perspective, but actually it's a very straight line. I mean, he was for us against them. He's for the people. He was against the imposition of big money, big, you know, nanny state, you know, dominant authoritarian government in whatever form it took. So actually, I always regard Alexander as having pursued a very undeviating course, actually, throughout his, certainly all the time he lived here.
If people working in the mainstream media or independent journalism were to take home a lesson or two from your brother, what would you say they should take with them?
Be honest. Don't... you know, always look for, always look for what they're really saying. Don't follow sort of, you know, the party lines, because they'll certainly take you on an undulating course. I think you know, stick up for what is right. That sounds kind of trite and pat, but it's, you know, if you look at the mainstream media, you find a lot of cases where that, you know, that doesn't happen.
Do you think we need more journalism from a perspective as opposed to an attempt at balanced or neutral reporting?
Well, let's, you know, I think everyone should try and be, you know, balanced or neutral, but I mean, that's, but at the same time, you admit everything is from perspective. I mean, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, completely, I mean, it's a myth and a fiction that there are such things as unbiased reporters. I mean, you should differentiate that from honest reporting. I mean, we should all be honest in our reporting and, you know, get the facts right and, you know, be fair in presenting, you know, whatever facts are relevant. But to say, you know, oh, I'm absolutely unbiased, like, say, the New York Times does, when it clearly isn't, I think, it, you know, is a hypocrisy and should be avoided at all costs, which Alexander certainly did and urged others so to behave.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, you're welcome.
That was Andrew Coburn. He's a journalist, author, brother of the late Alexander Coburn. Alexander's last book is A Colossal Wreck, a road trip through political scandal, corruption, and American culture.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we look back at the life of Jim Henson, creator of The Muppets and Sesame Street.
And we'll explore cow tipping, the idea of tipping over cars as cows as a recreational activity. Is that really a thing or not?
Probably easier a cow than a car.
I'm not down with it either way.
Well, we'll hear the latest installment of the WPR News series about the Gideon Trials as well tomorrow.
And Science Friday host Ira Flatow joins us. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The summer vacation season might feel already like a distant memory, and with the start of fall, we're left with stories of where we've been and what we've seen.
Writer John Hildebrand thinks the best memories come when things go wrong in this episode of Wisconsin Life.
What remained memorable after a journey are the things that went wrong. The capsized boat, the detour to nowhere, that supper at the Nightmare Cafe. These mishaps gain in reflection because they can be put into a story, and it's the story you remember. There's no narrative to pretty sunsets or waiters who aren't surly, so the perfect vacation fades over time. Misfortune, on the other hand, makes the world feel strange and new, and isn't that the point of travel? Forget where you're going, says the blown tire. Look where you are. I used to enjoy hitchhiking for its randomness. Thumbing to Fort Lauderdale one spring break to visit a girl, I narrowly missed being hit by a 60-mile-per-hour grapefruit hurled from a screaming white convertible. But here's the point. I can no longer picture the girl I was hitchhiking to see, only the yellow arc of grapefruit as it sailed past palmetto trees and smashed into the pavement at my feet as if to say, "Welcome to Florida." Over time, I came to recognize the hurled grapefruit for what it was. An unexpected gift. Tourism, paying X amount of dollars for X amount of fun, isolates the traveler from locals and makes it harder to distinguish acts of kindness from contractual obligations. But anyone who's ever stopped to ask directions knows the best way to ingratiate yourself with locals is to show incompetence. Motorcycling across Nova Scotia, I was once marooned when my engine conked out at a little gas station in the middle of nowhere. Roaring into the station earlier, I'd been of no interest. But once I was transformed into a man of misfortunes, the locals couldn't do enough for me. One fellow put me up for the night. Another drove me and the bike to a repair shop in Halifax. When I offered to buy him breakfast, he refused. I'd been a problem, and once solved, he saw no reason to reverse our roles. The rest of the trip was beautiful in ways I no longer recall. Now that I'm the one planning family trips, I try to limit randomness. I make lists, study the map, keep an eye on the weather. On a recent trip to Door County, we pitched our tent by Duck Bay. That night, I awoke to thunder that boomed louder and louder as if the storm was stomping down the stairs in a bad mood. The walls bellowed in and out, and I realized the tent wasn't staked down. To keep us from parasailing into the night, I stretched my body the length of the tent, arms and legs splayed. Between lightning flashes, my wife told the children it appeared Gumby was having a nightmare. Next morning, a new tributary flowed through the tent toward Lake Michigan and made islands of our sleeping bags. Everything was soaking wet. Afterwards, we all agreed it was the best part of the trip.
John Hildebrand teaches English at UW-Eau Claire and is the author of three books, including A Northern Front.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find out more information at wisconsinlife.org. When you hear the name M. Night Shyamalan, your mind probably goes to one of his movies, like this one.
I'm ready to communicate with you now.
Communicate?
Tell you my secrets.
What is it?
You know the accident up there?
Yeah.
Someone got hurt.
They did?
A lady. She died.
Oh my God, but you can see her?
Yes.
Where is she?
Standing next to my window.
And that is a clip from The Sixth Sense, written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. These days he's got another passion, rebooting education in America and closing the achievement gap.
As co-founder of the M. Night Shyamalan Foundation, he got interested in exactly what the formula is for successful schools that empower their students. He writes about what he found in his new book.
M. Night Shyamalan joins us now to talk about that book. It's called I Got Schooled, the unlikely story of how a moonlighting movie maker learned the five keys to closing America's education gap. And Knight, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us, how did a successful filmmaker like you get drawn into the debate about public education in America?
Oh, you know what? I hope I'm not in the debate. You know, it's such a contentious field. It really is. It's a fascinating field. It was really just organic. It kind of started on a location scout for a movie where I was looking at local high schools in Philadelphia to shoot in. And there was one particular high school that really moved me because it was so dire, the situation with the metal detectors and the bars on the school rooms and the classrooms, and the theater was burnt down by, you know, suspicious situation, and the whole floor of the school was shut down because of rampant drug use and sex acts, and it was just a very dark thing, and these were kids. And then the next school we went and saw was beautiful, and it was just a few minutes away, and they're both public schools in Philly, and really just started me wondering what the differences were and wanting to ask questions, and it was very organic. And then ultimately it turned into a 4.5-year research project with researchers that we hired through our foundation and me flying all over the country to talk with the experts and the people that had done the research, to find out just what had been proven, with no everybody's opinions put aside. You know, we all have opinions about how to raise our kids and other people's kids and what's best for schools. But I really wanted to write a book that wasn't about opinion at all, that I had no opinion. In fact, that I was an outsider and had nothing to do with the field was a great advantage, because I wasn't seen as an enemy on either side or any side. And got to just I just wanted the answer to a few questions. One was, what has been proven? And is that enough to close the gap? And the answers came, and the answer to the second part was yes.
Well, you tell a story in the beginning of your book about your beginnings into this new passion area for you, education. And you have this philanthropic organization, the M. Night Shyamalan Foundation. And to start with, it sounds like you gave scholarships to underprivileged kids, and at one point you had dinner with them. Can you tell us about that dinner and how it made you feel?
Yeah, you know, I guess when you have a foundation, the first thing you do is, you know, you think it'll be simple. You think, you know, people will come with wonderful causes and you'll write checks and everybody will benefit. And to some extent, I guess that's correct. But in another way, the money is never the thing. You know, the world needs human capital. And you realize that slowly when you write checks. And then you write the check and you think everything's going to be better. We have a dinner with all these kids that were the most worthy kids from the public schools in, you know, inner city Philadelphia to go to college. And so I wrote the checks and we had dinner with them. And I just knew in my gut after talking to them that they weren't ready. They weren't ready for what was ahead of them. And they were lost and weren't prepared for the world outside and didn't have the internal landscape that was necessary to believe in themselves. And you could feel that I wasn't helping. And yes, those were opportunities for those kids, and that was a wonderful thing for them. But they would have benefited more if more had been done on the other side before we had gotten to the table. And so really, it was necessity and a set going, okay, I need to put my time in. I need to go find out. Before I act, I want to learn. And, you know, spending the years learning, it was moving. I didn't realize it was going to be something that I would just keep on doing, but, you know, I was just inspired by what people had found. You know, it was a little bit of a puzzle, and I guess I'm very intrigued by puzzles, both in a fictional sense and in a literal sense. And this idea, when you go into the education field, it's so caustic, and everybody is so acrimonious, and one side screaming at the other, and then one saying, you have to do this, and the other side, you have to do that. Well, I just wanted to kind of go in the middle and just say, you know, this is what I found when I put all the information together on one table, when I used money and researchers and we organized it all. This is what we found. Is everyone clear about what's been proven and what hasn't?
Now, there are a lot of heavy hitters who are trying to tackle just the same question that you were trying to do on your own. You've got people like Diane Ravitch, Arne Duncan, even Ron Paul, who has his own new education plan. Was it daunting for you to wade into those waters?
Yeah, you know, I think that they're the ones fighting the fight, all those people you mentioned. And so they have so many stakes in the fire, and they have so many positions, and they have so many years they put into different positions. You know, like if I said, you know, like, let's just say I was a strong advocate for reducing classroom size for 4 years, it would be very hard for me to hear the real information about classroom size and hear what's been proven and what hasn't. It's easier for an unbiased person to come in and say, this is the information. Now, are you taking actions from that information? Those guys know way more about how to do something in a classroom or anything like that. And that's what I wanted to stay out of was, I have no expertise in this genre. All I did was research and research and research. And said, did you know this? Do you know that these are the things that have been proven? And then when you look at the schools closing the gap, they're doing those same exact things. So it was very heartening for me, actually, the 4.5 years, because it was confirming that there was an answer. It's a very hard answer, but there's an answer, and it's being done.
Now, there are 5 keys that you identified as you visited these schools and talked to experts over 4.5 years. And we're going to hit pause for a moment and listen to the headlines. But can you give us the first one of these keys, and then we'll come back and get the rest?
You know, there's no kind of hierarchy to the ones that we found. This is ultimately what was found from the research. And I guess in a way, this was the kind of click thing that happened to me while I was doing it. At first, it all felt contradictory and jumbling. There were you know, reports where there were positives and then there was negatives, and I didn't understand how you could get to research papers that said that, you know, seemingly the opposite. And then when I looked at it from the paradigm of, and this came from a friend of mine who's a doctor, and he teaches his residents, who he supervises at University of Penn, that if they do kind of the simple 5 things of health together, meaning sleep 8 hours a day, have a balanced diet, work out 3 times a week, don't smoke, have a low-stress kind of work or mental environment, if you pay attention to your mental health, those 5 things, all your chances of having all diseases drops dramatically. Mm. But the key is you have to do them together. If you don't do one of them, if you do 4 of them and you smoke, your chances of getting diseases moves right back to the norm. And it drives to the norm, right back to equilibrium with the general population. And I went, oh, my gosh, maybe that's why I'm getting false negatives and false positives. You know, this might explain things. So I went looking with that paradigm for the next few years. Are there a set of things, when they're done together, close the achievement gap? And it turns out there are. And that was kind of the breaking of the code moment that happened. And so you can't do any of them alone. So for example, one of the things we found in the research is that when principals, first of all, we found when they're great, the good principals have incredible impact on every classroom in the school. They can raise the achievement of every classroom in the school. So you can imagine how important this person is. And the research shows when that person is actually teaching the teachers, when they spend 80% of their time teaching teachers. By that I mean they're in classrooms. They're observing the teacher in math and saying, you know, you need to do this better. You know, acknowledge Sarah in the back of the class. Talk louder. Do this. Do that. You know, ask more questions. Whatever it is, all the best practices that they have found, when they're teaching the teachers 80% of the time, the teachers get better and they're supported and the system works. So now, let's just put that aside for a second. And you say that's one of the aspects we found in the research. But that can't happen in a giant school.
And we're going to stop there and come back and get the rest of that as we talk now with filmmaker M. Night Shyamalan. Besides filmmaking, as you heard, he's passionate about education and wrote a book about it called I Got Schooled.
I'd like to hear what you think about improving schools at 800-642-1234 or go to our Facebook page, Central Time on WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation with filmmaker and writer M. Night Shyamalan. As a moonlighting movie guy, he got passionate about education and spent years talking to experts and visiting schools to find out what could help close the achievement gap in America. His new book is called I Got Schooled. And Night, you were in the middle of telling us about the five keys of education, how they have to work in tandem, and the role of principals in creating a culture where students learn and succeed. Tell us what's next.
You know, I was kind of touching on the fact that they have to be done together, and that was kind of the big epiphany for all of us when I was doing the research over the years, that there was a connection, that they all had to be done together, otherwise they would kind of have cancellation effects. So when we were talking about what a great principal does in the research, you know, they spend 80% of their time teaching teachers, and they create an incredibly strong culture in this school. They and it's uniform, the culture. Everyone buys in. The janitor, the secretary, everyone buys into the culture. And the students, when they walk through those doors, have to hear a culture that's stronger than the one that they're hearing when they walk outside the doors. And the one outside the doors is incredibly strong, right? That's the one that's saying, you're worthless, you're second-class citizens, this country doesn't love you, we built you, we don't believe you're the same as everybody else, all those things. You don't have opportunities, all the things that they're whispered constantly from where they live, from their environments, in their homes, everything, right?
People like that are rare, though. I mean, how do you get a principal like that in every school?
Well, see, that's the thing. When you do all of them, you don't have that rare principal. See, great principals don't have traits that are great. The research says that great principals do certain things. So it's not that you need when we're trying to do, for example, the whole set of the research that's found, the findings are to create a system that almost everyone can succeed in closing the gap, as opposed to the Michael Jordans, right? Just the Michael Jordan teacher, or what they refer to as Superman and Waiting for Superman, the great, you know, the Jeffrey Canadas, or somebody that's like extraordinary. You don't want to have a system that only relies on them as principals or as teachers. You want to have the great majority be able to succeed. And that's why doing all of the things that were found in the research together makes it doable for everyone to succeed, the great majority of teachers and principals to succeed. And that's the goal, obviously.
Okay, so you mentioned the principals. And what about the rest of the five?
Well, I was actually saying in conjunction with the principals, one of the tenants is actually small schools. Now, for example, like the Gates Foundation funded a lot of small schools and did that solely. And what they found is there wasn't a lot of, you know, great benefit to doing that. And that's going to be a false negative. The only thing you'll get if you just reduce class school size is higher graduation rates. And that in and of itself is a wonderful thing. But the reason that you put small school size is so the principal can do the things that he needs to do with such intensity and such personal aspect, creating a culture, teaching the teachers. There's only so many classrooms he can spend time in or she can spend time in, and there's only so many teachers he or she can work with one-on-one. That's what we found in the research, that once you tip past that tipping point, it's impossible to create that culture. It's impossible for the principals to have that kind of one-on-one kind of situation going on. And so you can see how a false positive and a false negative happens in the research. And again, the schools that are closing the gap are of a certain size and do have a certain type of principal activity behind them.
Okay, and what about things like adding more time in school?
You know what? You know the fascinating thing? There's no hierarchy to the things that we found. You know, like everyone's always hyped about, let's say, one of the tenants is removing what I refer to as roadblock teachers, the very, 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 very bottom percent of the teachers that are actually dragging the kids so much. And everyone gets so hyped about that, but that would not be, if you were only going to do one thing, like you said, I'm not going to do all five tenants, that's never going to happen, I'm only going to do one, that would not be the thing I would do first. In fact, that wouldn't be the thing I would do second or third or fourth. Now, this is my opinion, but from the research, adding extra time is the way to combat the education gap the fastest way. So you guys know what the summer slide is and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like the summer slide is like when, like, say there's an African American kid in the inner city in June of their second grade year, and a white kid in suburban somewhere in America. They're at the same level in June, right? Just let's say when they come back in September, the inner city kid is 3 months behind where he was when he left in June. And the white suburban kid is 1 month ahead of where he was when he left in June. And that's from their home environments, their exposure in their neighborhoods, from their lack of stimulation, their lack of getting new things, whatever it is. It could be as blatant as going to museums or going on trips or hearing vocabulary or being introduced to different ideas. But those are the facts. And so that same kid, those two kids look like different kids in September. They're 4 months apart. And you just keep adding that and adding that and adding it, and you have your giant gap. And it seems like one group of kids can't learn and one group of kids can learn. And it's just not the case. And the schools that have closed the gap are using the extra time. They extend the school day and they extend the school year into the summer. There's a guy that we fund in Philly. His name is Alejandro, and he started a thing called Springboard Collaborative, and he does a 5-week reading workshop in Philly now. He does about 800 kids. Those kids, astonishingly enough, get 3-month gains. These are the same inner city kids that are randomly chosen. 3-month gains in his 5-week course. Now, you're hearing me right. That means that they are 6 months ahead of their inner city peers, and they are 2 months ahead of their white suburban counterparts. So now there's a gap the other way. This isn't about the kids. This is about the environment that they're in.
Now, you make a compelling case. Are people listening to you, or are they saying, yeah, I like this guy's films, but he's a filmmaker. Why should I listen to him?
Well, I have nothing to do with this. This is not, I haven't proven anything. Every single one of the things I just said has been proven by experts. So all I'm saying to the legislators or anybody that would say something like that, I go, I don't have an opinion. I think it's really cool when teachers are really fun and cool and hip and wear T-shirts and do stuff. That is, I don't know. I have no opinion. I'm an idiot.
But you are saying that that we need to do the 5 steps in tandem. That seems to be the sort of magic formula.
Yeah, all I'm saying is the research says this. You don't have to do it. The research says this is how you stay healthy. The research says this is how you close the achievement gap. And then I say, and here are the 50 schools in the country that are doing it, and they're closing the gap. So it's not an opinion. The research isn't untested. It's being proven every single day in these schools. So you guys can do what you want. I just want everyone to be clear. If you smoke, you have a higher chance of getting sick. As long as everyone knows that, and then they choose to smoke, that's a different situation. I just want everyone to have I didn't have the information, and I just want everyone like me who is interested in education to have the correct information. And then I believe over time the right decisions will be made, and the ship will start turning in the right direction. Just like it takes a while, like the health model, it took a while, right? You know, when I was younger, the people that worked out were like Jack LaLanne. It was like crazy. And now you don't even look at an apartment unless there's a workout facility in the apartment, right? That's just standard now. And that's become a part of our lives, a normal part of our lives. But 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. And I believe, you know, hopefully the turn will be quicker. But knowledge is the first thing. Whether with the will to do what's been proven, that's another thing entirely.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was filmmaker M. Night Shyamalan. His new book is called I Got Schooled.
Coming up next, our guest says the Environmental Protection Agency's limits on carbon emissions are bad for the American economy.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.